Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for March 14, 2024, in its 24th year, the James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroad. And tonight, many topics, but how does money affect science? Science is big business. Make no mistake about it, the way it is structured today. And one thing, I made a decision early in my career that I was not going to be influenced by money, by government money, etc. And when I would go to meetings, which I would pay for myself, I would, you know, everybody else, 20,000 scientists at an American Geophysical Union meeting, I was the only person there that paid my own way, bought the airline tickets, made my posters, took them to the print shop, printed them up, did not have a staff of artists like the NASA scientists or whatever, and registered my own hotel room and, you know, my own food, whatever it was. If there was an excursion trip, I paid for that myself. They always had an excursion of some kind. And so, and you know, it never was a big money maker for me. But it's interesting that after all of these decades, 50 years now and counting, that what I've done in my work, in my theoretical work, and people acknowledge this to me. They say, how do you, these are tier one scientists that came out to ask me how things work. This is where you have laboratories like Los Alamos or other tier one level science institutions. And they couldn't figure something out, and they would come to me and they'd ask me, and I'd just say, okay, here's what's going on. And they have teams of the best scientists. Now, just understand the structure of tier three, tier two, tier one science. Tier two science, you have tens of thousands. And the very best ones, and you can tell them a mile away, the good ones, the ones that are really going to make a difference, the ones that have their head screwed on straight and really understand. They're not just the ones that make the, you know, do the problems in the back of the book. Or, you know, you can get a PhD easily in most sciences. Physics is hard. Believe me, it's very hard. You have to put in a lot of time. But if you're halfway good, you can get a PhD. But then these certain people, and you can tell there's mental characteristics also. They're just a step above. And those people get plucked out. Somebody's there watching them all through their graduate school, etc., plucks them out and says, hey, come over here. We got a better deal for you, and offers them a tier one science position, military lab in a private company or something that's doing security military work or something like that. But see, once they get to that stage, you never see or hear them from them again. They are locked in on contract, and they're there for life. Once they sign in, and of course they get a lot of money for this, and that's the thing. They don't own anything that they do. Now, to the contrary, I own everything that I do. I copyright it, I patent things, I trademark things, and so I own everything that I do. Big difference. I have some peer-reviewed published papers, and when it came time for me to duplicate those, for example, in the appendix of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, I have some papers that were peer-reviewed publications. I had to go to the journal and ask permission, and of course they gave me permission to reprint, not a problem. But you have to ask and then show that you gave permission to reprint those articles. The Saturn sweeper moons predicted, and the continuing galactic formation paper, peer reviewed. That's when I was at Cornell. But if you hear some background noise here, I don't even want to explain it. But there's some you might notice occasionally some background noise. But anyway, when I was in college, my first year in college, I got an offer to the Naval Academy. It was a senator appointment. And so I would have been, a military science physicist. I would have gone through there in physics. And but as it turned out, I turned that down the night before I was supposed to pack my bags and go to Annapolis. I called up the secretary. Al Quie was the senator from the state I was from, Minnesota. He had two appointments to the military academy schools, and I was one of them. I had done all my testing. I'd done the physical testing, the mental testing, everything else, and I was ready to go. And the guy, I was in the university band. I was the bass player, upright string bass, violin. I had learned classical violin when I was in high school, amongst other instruments, but that was my official instrument. And so I was in a stage band at the college where I was going to school in physics. And the head of the band came up to me and he says, "Yeah, I hear we're losing you here. And what's going on?" So I told him, I said, "Yeah, I'm going to the Naval Academy. After the first year, they said I can transfer to the Air Force Academy because that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to be in the Air Force. And I wanted to fly the jet planes, high performance jet planes. I thought that'd be pretty cool." And he goes, "Well, you'll be dropping napalm on people in the jungle and killing people and probably end up in a bamboo cage, if you get shot down." And anyway, I didn't really know what was going on, So anyway, he talked to me for a while, and I thought, "Whoosh, I'm not in for this. This is not my wheelhouse, as they might say." So anyway, I called up the secretary the next morning, the day I was supposed to show up, and called Al Qui's secretary, and I told her, "I'm not going. I'm turning down this offer." And she goes, "What are you talking about? Nobody turns down a military academy appointment. These are rare. This is an honor. This is, And I said, "Well, I'm turning it down. Sayonara." And so, I'm sure they had a long list of people that were ready to jump in and take my spot. But I would have been one of those tier one military physicists. That's what I was going to be. But at any rate, I've had many different turns and twists in my career, but that was one of them. If you want to hear more about the history of my life, there's when the web page finally gets put together here, it should be together ready for sale. The products. There's one of them is a series, 52 lectures on my history, the history of my discoveries, which is also basically the history of my work and myself. It's not the science, it's the history, what was going on, etc. So anyway, I talk more about those kind of incidents. But going back, let's go back to the beginning of the 1900s, back in the 1800s, the days of Cauchy and Riemann and Einstein's early days and Tesla's early days and the science, the Bohr atom, the quantum physics, the initiation of quantum physics and everything. Now, a lot of these people were associated with universities, but a lot of them were not. And a lot of them did private research. So, in fact, the Nobel Prize was initially started, and the whole idea was that some guy was working in his laboratory, working and breaking ground in new discoveries and key discoveries would be awarded a Nobel Prize. But now it's institutionalized where the Nobel Prize is being given to teams of government-supported science. Never, ever was it meant to be that way. But of course, this is getting back to my original theme, where money controls science. politics controls science. Powerful people control scientific topics, what scientific theories of the day are touted, which ones get into textbooks, which ones don't, etc. But it's become this monopoly, it's a game of monopoly in which, kind of like banking, once the winners get installed in place, they can eat up the competition to where they have a pure monopoly. You know, pick another field, you know, maybe the drug cartels, something very similar, where they're creating a monopoly. But anyway, the next subject I want to talk about, and I've brought this up before, homeowner insurance. Now, let's take a thing called climate change. One of the biggest hoaxes ever to walk out of the scientific establishment. There, luckily and thankfully, there are thousands and thousands of really good scientists stepping forward today and saying what I've been saying since the very inception, that this is a political hoax, it's a political football, it's a hoax has a huge amount of money behind it. And let's take an example right now about homeowners insurance. There was recently a study done by a private group, and this is what these companies do. If you look at the history of, for example, fluoridation in water, what was Alcoa Aluminum had to get rid of its toxic fluoride waste. The Manhattan Project and the nuclear industry in the United States used sodium fluoride as part of its process for cleaning the uranium and isolating uranium to then make into bomb-grade fuel, and then also for the nuclear industry for fueling the electric industry. But huge, huge amounts of money. But the fluoride industry came about because they had to get rid of this toxic waste. And so what did they do? They somehow convinced people that it was good for your teeth and that you could put it in the city water. There's a lot more information coming out on this these days. But once again, a scientific hoax that was controlled by big money interests. Climate change is exactly that. So it's turned into a thing where they can't reverse it. You know, the boogeyman is the climate change has been used and to control water rights, to control legislation, to put the clamps down, like Canada, other countries, Canada, you know, New Zealand, Australia, the British-owned colonies around the world, all have climate change taxes that have been put on the public. So, for example, in Canada, everybody that breathes, if you walk down the street, there's a carbon tax that's put on that. And the tax really doesn't cure the problem. It simply taxes you for going about your daily business. And it's a major cause of inflation because all of the products have every step along the way from the garnering of the natural resources, any resources that are used or any companies that are in the supply chain or production chain or whatever it is to bring a product to market, every piece of that is taxed with a carbon tax. And at the end, guess what? The prices go through the roof and people can't afford them and the money goes to the government where there's just a big put it in your pocket. And that's another thing too. Just look at government by itself. Money controls government. Government doesn't control money. Money controls government and politicians and the legislation and laws that are passed and like climate change. But let's look at an industry, the home insurance industry, where millions and millions of homes across the United States are required to have home insurance by, especially if they have a bank loan. The bank, well, of course, they've got an investment. They want to make sure that if something happens to it, it's covered. They will get their money back because the owner is on a loan. The owner doesn't have any equity in the house to speak of. 99% of people with house loans don't have any equity in the house at all. So if there was a bad incident, the people could just walk away and leave the bank with it. So the bank requires that individuals with bank loans, which is 99% of all houses in the country, maintain house insurance, homeowners insurance. And then typically in places like Florida, you'll have a hurricane rider that goes on top of that, and you have to keep that too to protect the bank's interest. So unless you're one of the very few people that were lucky enough or savvy enough for whatever reason were able to buy a house with cash, then you're strapped with this house insurance, and it is going up 1,000% in some cases. It's been going up for years. But now what they're doing is they're saying because of climate change, and this has been documented by studies by individual think tank groups, and of course they're both well selected, just like with the all of these other things. In fact, I'm going to quickly read a list here of things that are like that. Fluoride in the water, COVID, the whole COVID thing was a big money maker. Home insurance, climate change related to the cost of goods, minimum wage. Here's another thing that it's like a feel-good thing for politicians. Oh, we're going to raise the minimum wage, really help out the lower class. And what happens is that the small business is the one that's truly affected. They're the ones that are getting really hit by the raising minimum wage, and it drives them out of business. It's that extra few percent because most businesses run on probably a 5% margin. After all the bills are paid, the light bill, the heat bill, the rent, the stock, the inventory, the cleaning lady, everything else that goes with it, the transportation related to things, etc. All of, the insurance, everything else that goes in a business. Most businesses, small businesses might run, and big businesses, run on a 5% margin. Well, the big box stores can absorb some of that and then pass some of it off to the public, but in general, keep their prices lower. So what do the public do? They want the best price for a product, so they go to the big box store. Everybody's guilty of that. There's probably nobody that's not guilty of that. So Walmart wins. The small businesses go out of business, and guess what? Walmart becomes a monopoly. So they're in there pumping the legislators for minimum wage. Increase that minimum wage. It's good for those big box stores. Okay, let's look at some other things that are set in stone because of monetary interest that NASA went to the moon. Okay, did they go to the moon or not? I'm not going to discuss that here. The reality is whether they went or didn't go, whether you believe they went or didn't, but it's science is not a matter of belief. Whether you believe they did or didn't, it's not a matter of belief. But the bottom line is it is big, big, big business. A lot of money flowing through NASA and into other companies all over the country. So money controls the narrative. NASA has to say they went to the moon. They're on a program now. They just had a special on 60 Minutes. The guy starts out and goes, "It's been 50 years since NASA was at the moon." No proof. The guy probably wasn't even born when the Apollo program was going on, the guy that's doing the announcing. And then they interview the controller of NASA, and he goes, "NASA just doesn't have enough money to do what we're doing. We need more money," in a subtle way, in a backdoor kind of way, saying that. But that's the gist is it costs a lot of money to go to space. When you see third-party, independent, private companies failing to get to the moon time after time after time. This latest one where it supposedly fell over on its side because some guy forgot to throw a switch on, with a, leaving it to a laser rangefinder instead of, or the laser rangefinder was turned off. So it's like a physical switch, which you would never have on a spacecraft. You would have redundancy. You would have other ways to turn that on and off or whatever. But anyway, this story doesn't add up. But this is something I've been meaning to talk about and throw this in here, is that when companies or other countries try to go into space, there is going to be, there has been, there is ongoing sabotage of companies. And these companies, the three that have actually made it to the moon, to land on the moon, my belief, and it's very clear from multiple points of view, is that they were sabotaged because NASA has a hand in these. And did they actually get to the moon? Well, maybe they did. Maybe they're transmitting, but the message that comes back is that that the project failed. And then, of course, the stock goes down in these companies, and who gets to walk in? The stockholders come in and pick up the company for nothing, and telling the engineering staff on the project that it failed when it really didn't fail. It did not fail. And this is very easy to see too, because the reasons that are giving for the failure are just bogus. And the other thing is a real indicator is that multiple systems failed at the same time, a very critical time, 50 feet above the ground as this thing is trying to land. What other oil and war, huh? Big business, big business. And things like pure science, like the Eddington experiment back in the early days in the 1900s. Eddington, Arthur Eddington, faked the famous eclipse data where he went to an island and put up his nice telescope and took data. If you look at the actual photographs that he took, he cherry-picked the data to prove, or so-called prove, general relativity, and nobody has ever duplicated that experiment. Nobody. And you have 100-plus years now of people running around talking about general relativity as if it were proof, and the experiment that it all relies on was faked. Arthur Eddington cherry-picked the data. If you look at the actual data, the star movement was all over the place. It was not radial in most cases, and it was not proportional to the distance from the center of the sun. Faked data, 100 years. Einstein knew that, but once this thing got a life of its own, and then, Arthur Eddington and only a few people could understand relativity, and Einstein was a good scientist and he rejected it. Einstein himself said general relativity doesn't work. And he was literally, when he was his last day on Earth as a human being, Einstein was studying Velikovsky's work. And the reason he was studying Velikovsky's work at Princeton, where Velikovsky and him were buddies, the reason I know that is, like I tell people, if you hear something on my show or on, when I'm on an interview, it's because I have firsthand information. It's not because I read it in a book somewhere or saw it on somebody's web page or something. No, it's because I know personally. And the reason I know personally is because I was good friends with Warner Sizemore. Warner Sizemore was Velikovsky's personal secretary. He was with Velikovsky every day. And that's why there are some charlatans that say they had met Velikovsky, they had come to his house and visit, and no, they didn't, because Warner Sizemore would have known about it. He was there at all times. He was with Velikovsky in Princeton, and Einstein would come over to Velikovsky's house for supper. Come over, and he'd play the violin, and they'd eat supper and talk. But Einstein his last days were studying Velikovsky's work because Velikovsky talked about electricity in outer space. And Einstein was searching for that. And by the way, that's something that my work put the cap on. It discovered what was going on. What was the Venus event? What are the electrical conditions in the solar system? And I found the thing that Einstein was looking for. I call it the induced electric dipole redshift. It's the bending of light with non-uniform electric fields. And where does that come from? The non-uniform electric field comes from a non-uniform distribution of charge in the solar wind. None of these things were available in Einstein's day when he died. None of this information was available, nor satellite data, etc. So there's no way he could have known about this. And when I ended up at Cornell in 1979 to 81, I had all this theoretical work in place because I had already been working with electromagnetic fields in gravitational systems. That's what I was doing. And of course, Sagan and the boys didn't want to have any part of that. And, you know, I was saying there, and by the way, I did not know Velikovsky. I didn't know about Velikovsky at all. When I was at Cornell, it wasn't until I was actually leaving Cornell that I found out. I was talking on the phone to a friend of mine, and I was telling him about my theoretical work just in general, and he goes, "It sounds like that Velikovsky guy." And I said, "Well, who's Velikovsky?" Here I am at Cornell in the backyard of Carl Sagan, whose lifelong project was to bury Velikovsky, and I didn't even know about it because I had been out of the country for about a decade teaching in a foreign university. So anyway, and by the way, that is where I got my title, professor. Thank you very much. And a lot of people ask me how did, because I only taught 2 years at Cornell and I was an instructor. Well, no, I didn't earn my title as professor there. I already had it. That's why they hired me at Cornell, because I was very experienced teaching in multiple language, physics, etc. So anyway, I talk about that also in the history of my work. But getting back to the story about Einstein and his work on the electromagnetism. He said in his autobiography of Einstein, it's called Out of My Later Years. You can find it in a good library. Out of My Later Years, I don't remember the page number, but it might vary depending on the edition of that book you get. But Einstein said in there that he did not agree with general relativity because it did not include the total field. And that's exactly what he was working on, the grand unification of the fields, which included gravity, of course, electricity, magnetism, and then the nuclear forces. And then there's some other nuclear forces that were known about, but that's what he was working on. And of course, he did not believe that gravity would affect light. And as he said, why would gravity affect light when we don't know any of the sources for light bending or redshift of light based on electromagnetic effects? And that's what Einstein said, and he was absolutely correct. But he knew enough to ask the question, but he didn't have the answer. Okay, but anyway, there again, Eddington was I don't know if you'd call him a narcissist, but in terms of retrospect, looking at him, what he did, cherry-picking the data to prove general relativity so that he could be the smartest man in the world, along with Einstein, was, I would say that's pretty indicative of a person that's a narcissist, that is focused on himself to the point where he's willing to fudge data on one of the biggest international alleged discoveries in history. Special relativity had already been well proven and understood in all the various things, time dilation, the relative frames of reference, the the various effects of special relativity had been, the redshift of special relativity, which, the velocity of light being constant in all frames of reference, etc. Very, very odd physics. And there again, Einstein was the guy that came along and turned the key, because a lot of people had been working around this, Michelson and Morley, a lot of really good physicists, Thomson, there was just a lot of really, really good physicists at that time, delving into the subatomic world and in the quantum world. But it was Einstein that put the key in and turned it. And that's what, and that's what's really strange with the special relativity and general relativity, which was not correct, but so-called proven. The Einstein got in on so many other things. The photoelectric effect was what Einstein got the Nobel Prize for. But it was like there were probably two dozen things they could have picked any one of them to give him a Nobel Prize. But it's interesting that they did not pick relativity. So that you have to kind of scratch your head about what was going on there. But because the photoelectric effect was a very important to understanding the wave and particle nature of light. But on the other hand, it was not as major as special relativity. Okay, so getting back to money owning science, money controlling science. I just read off a list of things in, let's say, Big Bang, the Big Bang. Or let's see, here's one that's really a lot of money involved is fusion. How many times have you read or said, oh, it's just, some project is just on the cusp of unity, what they call unity, in other words, creating more energy than you put into it. These big, colossal accelerators where they have magnetic control, etc., they're trying to artificially create the conditions to set off nuclear fusion, where these are the light atoms that are forming, creating larger atoms, and then that change in mass E equals mc squared is giving off the energy. And but anyway, there's probably never been more money spent on something that's a you literally a big nothing burger. And now the whole problem here with fusion energy and fusion research is that the solar model is incorrect. The idea that the sun's fusion is in its core is simply incorrect. The Russians were able to prove my work that the fusion is in the atmosphere of the sun, and then also as a corollary in the atmospheres of Jupiter and Saturn, which are small unlit stars. So anyway, in summary, what I've been talking about is money and influence and monopolies controlling science. So it really, you can't call it science anymore. And remember, during the COVID thing, is follow the science. Science proves. You had news announcers saying the science is, I'm sorry, but people that could probably hardly spell science are using it to tell people that whatever it is, whether it's fluoride or COVID, get your COVID shot, or that house insurance you have to accept it going up because of climate change, and there's going to be bigger, more storms, so the insurance companies are bracing for this rather than after the fact. And they point to storms. Of course, there's always been storms. But the other thing about the insurance companies is they don't make their money off of your premiums. There's some kind of myth. It's like the insurance companies want to present this image that you pay your insurance premium, and then they put it in a box and hope that there's no claims. And then at the end of the year, then there's various people that put in claims. They had the wind damage or water damage or who knows, whatever the claims are. Maybe there's storms that tornado wipes out half of a little town or something, and they go, "Oh, look at that! The insurance company's going to have to pay." But the reality is, or the image is that the insurance companies want you to think that they're losing money because of climate change. That's the narrative. And your insurance is going to go from $1,000 a year up to 5,000 or maybe 7,000, potentially more than what you're paying for the house loan per year in insurance. And you're supposed to just accept this. And of course, it's going to bury people. This is all meant to bury the American middle class. That's what it's all about. In the name of climate change, which is a bogus pack of crap. That's all you can say about it. And then, see, the other thing they're trying to do now is pass laws that prevent you from saying bad things about government policies, which would include climate change, which would include COVID or fluoridation of water, or the whole laundry list of things I went through. But the insurance companies don't make money from your premium. That's a myth. What the insurance company does, when you pay your premium, they turn right around and they invest in real estate. That's the primary investment for insurance companies. Boy, would I like to have a business where people just give me money. I really give them a piece of paper back. A small percentage of what I take in gets paid out to some people that put in claims, but really, that the money that is given to the insurance company long before it ever gets used to pay out a claim is used to purchase real estate. And what's that real estate doing? Every month, there's somebody renting offices. If you look in any city or town, whatever, the biggest building is the government building. If there's a state capital there, it's the state government. The next biggest building would be the city government. Okay, the next biggest building would be basically insurance companies. And what do? They rent out that space, and every month they're making millions and millions of dollars off the space. That's where they make their money. They don't make money off of your premium. That goes back and forth, and they pay some money out, and they make enough money to pay their staff and their insurance salesmen and stuff. But the insurance company has all these holdings that are untouchable. So if they go out of business, they still have all these holdings. It's set up so that they're not liable to lose the holdings because they're living off of this cash flow. And just imagine if you had millions and millions and millions of homeowners paying you every month, and the bank requires it. That's a locked-in deal. So very few people, and even people who probably have paid for their home, probably still buy insurance. I heard of a case that's down in the Florida Keys that a woman had a house, and the hurricane came through. I forget which hurricane in the last year or two, devastated that. I think it was like the first island off of the in the Florida Keys. And the lady comes back, and there's just a cement pad there. Her million-dollar home was gone, and did not have insurance. But what can you say? Those are the risks that you take in when you're in hurricane country. But that is prime hurricane country. What they're saying now is that hundreds of miles inland in northern states, once you get up to like the Virginias, places like that, now they're saying that those states are susceptible to hurricane damage in the new climate change world. And so they're talking about especially California, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, and I imagine Georgia is going to be in on that, and then the other states to a lesser degree. But they're talking about people paying $10,000 a year for a small home, for the homeowner's insurance policy, which is just outrageous. And most people are going to just say, "Oh, I can't pay it." And it's then there'll be some kind of government study. Oh my goodness, how did things ever get to this position? Unbelievable. Okay, so just a quick announcement here. I put a sale on the water filter page, JMCC Water Filters, and it's a here's what's going on. We just have a little fundraising thing for a project that has to be completed, and so dropped the best deal. It's the MR5 whole house water filter, plus the UV sterilizer, plus an extra pack of filter elements. And that's what we call the best deal. And that's what most people buy. Maybe they'll buy another extra set of filter elements. But this is the whole house water filter. This is our just our legacy product in the business here. And normally it retails, that package, the best deal package, retails for $23.80. And now it's on sale for $13.80, literally $1,000 off. And of course, you have to have a plumber come out and put it in. So that savings will much more than pay for the plumber to get this thing installed. And I'm encouraging people to get especially a whole house water filter, because we don't know what they're going to be putting in the water. We think we know what they're putting in the water now, but I'll tell you, it's getting worse and worse. So I encourage people to take advantage of this, and there's only a few units that we're going to sell at that price, so they'll probably go pretty quickly, and then the price is going to go back up to normal. So once again, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay, now here's a really comical story, and this happened, I believe it was either in New Zealand or Australia. So there's a meteorite, what they call a bolide, and so this is not your average little pea-sized meteorite. You know, when you see a meteor stream and you see that streak across the sky, typically the piece of rock that's burning up is about the size of a pea, literally that small. And so when you get a pretty good sized rock coming in that burns up, a lot of times it breaks apart and chunks fall to the ground. It didn't burn up completely as it was coming into the atmosphere. And so then people go out and hunt for the pieces. Well, this story takes place, I believe it's in Australia, but anyway, there was a bolide that came in, and there was an announcement that what happened was there was a truck going down the road. And so these people saw seismic activity on one of their seismic detectors, and they said, "Oh, this thing must have hit near this detector." So they go out and they believed it had hit in the ocean. So they go out and they pick up this stuff out of the ocean and find that there's some kind of manufacturing involved in the pieces they're picking up. So they make the public claim that this is alien technology. Alien, not a rock just from outer space, which you might think, okay, an asteroid, okay, you got space rocks, you can study them. No, alien technology. And so anyway, then it comes out later that the bolide didn't even hit anywhere near this place, and it was a complete false alarm. And the pieces they picked up were actually man-made from something. Anyway, a colossal guffaw, that's all you can say. But I thought that was just an interesting story. The people actually got this into the news where they had thought they had discovered alien technology in the bottom of the ocean. So now here's another interesting story. You know, drones are being used more and more, and artificial intelligence more and more in warfare, in tactical warfare, in designing machines. The Abrams A1 tank, there's an X version now that is primarily artificial intelligence operated. So you have a machine here of war with no people in it. So is war coming to the point of robot versus robot? And was that like almost like a chess game that you're going to blow up robots out on the field? And it's actually happening where they pick an area like Ukraine or Gaza, and that's where there's going to be a war. And they just go in and destroy it. They absolutely destroy a place, knowing full well that that's, you know, the objective was to create a conflict and destroy an area, just to shell it into oblivion. And of course, this is good for business if you're in the armament business and selling shells. If you're stockpiling shells, and that's what happened back in the Trump era, as he built up the military because Obama had completely depleted it. Mr. Nobel Prize winning peace, Prince of Peace, Obama, depleted the entire military of ammo and machinery because it was just used so heavily. So when Trump came in, he built it back up, but he didn't have a war. He didn't have a war, so there was no place to use all the bullets and everything. Well, that changed in a hurry when the 2020 election was when the smoke cleared. That got changed real quick. Back to normal, good old policy where you got a good old-fashioned war going on. But at any rate, the story I wanted to talk about was a Russian anti-drone gun. And they showed a picture of this in a video clip. Very interesting. It looks like one of those guns that kids buy. It's like shoots little foam rubber things, or and they're typically big. They're kind of like bulky, kind of a Rambo kind of a gun, but for kids, kids' toys, etc. Which, by the way, I'm very opposed to because if kids go running around in the yard and there's something going on and police come, the police really don't know the difference between that and a real one. So it's a very, I think, presents a very potentially dangerous situation. But anyway, the Russian anti-drone gun looks very similar to one of those, that the toy manufacturers make for little kids. Those big, bulky, maybe they're a squirt gun, maybe they shoot these rubber darts or sponge darts or maybe paintballs, the same type of thing. But at any rate, this anti-drone gun is basically a high-powered linear radio signal, and you lock on to the drone, and it confuses the drone because the drone is typically operating with a form of radar, a distance separation, or GPS in a sense, to understand exactly where it is in relation to the controller that it left. And so, what the anti-drone gun does is simply jams the radio on the drone. The drone is confused, doesn't know where to go, so it just stops and sits there. Maybe it runs out of the battery, or maybe it tries to return to home, or maybe somebody will take a swipe at it and knock it out of the air, because now it's just going to hover there. It doesn't know what to do or where to go. It's not receiving commands like it normally would. I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk about what I'm doing now. Some people have asked, what are my current projects? What's going on? And currently, I'm archiving. And this is something that it's an ongoing process, but every day I'll sit, like today, for example, I sat down and I started to outline a new book, of which I have probably six on the shelf that are already well designed and just need some work to finish them off and get them published. But I started writing down the outline of a book, different chapter titles and some of the concepts that I wanted to include. And then I decided that instead of doing a book on that particular topic, it would be better for me to do a video. Okay, and so I'm going to pick up the sheet of paper I was working on today. So this is an entire sheet of paper. And then I started going through DVDs that I have topics to cover DVD, and these would be either 60 or 90 minute DVD lectures. And I ended up with 40, actually 40 of them that have titles and topics that excuse me, that would take a considerable amount of explanation in terms of a lecture, with supporting photographs and drawings, etc. But this is just a small part of what I've done with my work. A number of years ago, I did a series of lectures on this show talking about the history of my work. And here's the thing that happens in science. When you make a breakthrough discovery, a lot of times that leads to it opens up doors that weren't there before. And that might be the case, for example, with my work on prime numbers, or in the case of solar system electrodynamics, the fact that there's an excess current of protons in the solar wind. This creates a capacitor that might seem to be a very benign discovery, but it leads to thousands and thousands of other subtopics. Like, I'll just give you an example. On this show, I've talked about, for example, the Jupiter winds. And so, this is a condition where the planet Earth and Jupiter, about every 13 months, align electrically. So, they align electrically, and this is a fairly significant electron current because Jupiter has a almost cross-solar system electrical discharge. Not to mention that it has its own proton-supported wind and capacitor, and because it's a small unlit star, it has ongoing fusion in the atmosphere, and the excess current of protons was actually measured by the Voyager spacecraft, as reported in Science magazine, right up on the Voyager spacecraft, actually measuring that. But the Jupiter winds relative to the Earth have are caused by the solar capacitor discharging, and when Earth's solar discharge connects with that of Jupiter, we get a healthy dose, and it manifests itself in the form of straight line winds. And of course, we just had this a number of months ago. So, like I say, every 13 months, and what happens is it takes 12 months for Earth to go around the Sun once. And then, of course, Jupiter has moved somewhat in its orbit, so it takes us about another month to catch up with Jupiter again. So, it's about every 13 months. And so, this is just one of the byproducts of the understanding that there's an excess current of protons in the solar wind. Or another one might be the fact that planets are forming in the Kuiper Belt. And why are they forming there, and why are people actually discovering them? How are they forming? What's the process? Why is there material in that region of the solar system? Can we see these systems around other planets, or I mean around other stars, nearby stars? And the answer is yes. And that leads to say another fact that the microwave background radiation that is claimed by Big Bang people, that there's this background radiation that is reminiscent, a remnant of the Big Bang explosion, is not from the Big Bang at all. It's simply black body radiation, microwave background 3 degree radiation from the nebular ion cloud that's surrounding our solar system. And that you would not be able to actually verify the 3 degree background radiation as coming from the Big Bang unless you got outside of this, which nobody has ever been able to do, of course. That would be an experiment all of its own. But the rush to judgment, just like the Eddington experiment that I was talking about earlier, the rush to judgment in the scientific world, it just got railroaded through. And once it came into prominence and got published in the peer-reviewed journals, which, what a fallacy, what a complete fallacy, peer-reviewed journals. I have to get a kick out of people who sometimes these lame tier two or tier three wannabes out there try and criticize me, and they want to know about my peer review. Why don't I publish in peer-reviewed journals? Well, I have an entire page on my webpage dedicated to my experiences with peer-reviewed journals and the fact that real science really is never published in peer-reviewed journals. It's the tier two baloney garbage science that gets published in tier two peer-reviewed publications. And it's a monopoly. It's a form of monopoly. It's a way to keep the people involved in science in their monopoly position and a way to keep other people out. So anyway, back to my what I started talking about here is what am I doing recently? What I'm doing is summarizing the vast amount of work that I did over the past 50 years and putting it into a form that's understandable. And what's amazing here is that I've been working on this and forging ahead with new discoveries probably almost every week or at least every month in some areas. With the mathematics work that I'm doing, some of it dealing with prime numbers, some dealing with some other very interesting topics. The trick is that what I did is discover some basic new like rules of the road, things that people had never seen before or thought about before. And there again, that is due to all of these scientists and mathematicians being locked into monopoly systems, monopoly in funding, etc., and in peer-reviewed publications where, for example, dealing with prime numbers, mathematical analysis is a farce. It is absolutely absurd. Let me just speak to something here. Something I've done a lot of work on is the Riemann hypothesis. And it turns out, and it's very very well expressed in a book that I happen to have right here dealing with prime numbers. It's called, let me just pull this up here, Prime Obsession by John Derbyshire. And in the very last part of the book, he states, which is very true, that if the Riemann hypothesis were proven, that the zeros fall on the one-half, real one-half vertical line, that it wouldn't do anything to the understanding prime numbers, because for every zero relative to prime numbers, it really doesn't give you any predictive value. Okay, so at any rate, that's what I'm doing with my life lately, is archiving and forging ahead with new discoveries every week. Well, I'm about out of time here. Remember to go to my webpage. Remember the sale on the best deal, the MR5 whole house water filter, $1,000 off. We have a very few units that are going to be sold at that price. And if you get there, lucky you, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. And visit my regular page, jmccsci.com. And in the next day or two, the sales page will be up, that the new sales page. And I am out of time, so I'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.